First of all, I'd like to apologize for not releasing an episode last week. Basically, what happened was a series of mishaps. I'll explain at the end of the episode. If you'd like to hear more, stick around. Please remember to share this podcast with your friends and family, or even just total strangers. You know, show me your appreciation for my work. You can also leave the show a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to do more, get on patreon.com/societyofstrife and leave a $1 donation or more if you want. What I'm saying is support, support, support. If you're a fan and want this show to stick around for a long, long time, support us. As I've continuously said, podcasts, unlike any other form of media, require a lot of support so they can become widely available to everyone who is interested in stories. For example, you can be sure that there are plenty of people out there who are interested in stories like the ones I tell on this podcast. The only reason why they aren't listening right now is because they haven't heard anything about this show. So please spread the word and help me grow this show. So far, we have listeners from over 50 countries. I was hoping for over 100 countries by year's end. Please support the show and help me get it there. Now let's continue with the story, right where we left off last time. After a few days of discussions, the Bikinians decided to move to the Rongerik Atoll, which was approximately 200 kilometers from Bikini Atoll. They had a choice though. They could have moved to Rongelap, which was a lot better than Rongerik in terms of availability of amenities. They settled on Rongerik because they didn't want to live under the leadership of another chief, which they would have had to had they agreed to move to Rongelap. At the same time, the US government was lying to reporters. The Navy told reporters that Rongerik Atoll had more trees, was richer in food supplies, and even the coconuts were bigger. In reality, Rongerik Atoll was much smaller than Bikini and had far fewer resources. To really underscore the fact that the Bikinians had no say in the matter of evacuation, the US Navy gave them less than a month to leave Bikini and settle on Rongerik. On March 6, 1946, the day before the evacuation, the Bikinians visited the cemetery to say goodbye to their ancestors and family members. They decorated the graves with flowers and coconut fronds, and the next morning, on March 7th, they boarded a landing boat with everything they owned, or at least everything that they owned and could fit in a boat. A crane lifted their canoes and stowed them on deck. In preparation for their departure, the US Navy had transported tents, building supplies, and an American flag to Rongerik. The 200-kilometer journey lasted for just over 2 days. When they finally arrived on the 10th, two naval officials lifted an American flag over the island. After that was done, they left the Bikinians with fresh water and a month's supply of food. To the Bikinians, there was nothing to be worried about. They were under the impression that they would only be on the island for a few months, then they would return home. This story would be incomplete if we didn't talk about the tests. So, let's do that. The US Navy planned to detonate 3 bombs on the atoll. The first, Able, would be released in the air. The second, Baker, would be detonated underwater. And the third, Charlie, was cancelled. But we shall get into that later. In preparation for the tests, Navy workers built dormitories, laboratories, lunchrooms, clinics, and recreational facilities for the huge number of people expected to work in the area. I say huge because in total, the personnel numbered about 42,000 people. The workers even set up the first radio station in the Marshall Islands, calling it Radio Bikini. In preparation for the ships and atomic bomb tests, workers blasted large holes through the coral reef encircling Bikini Atoll so ships could enter the lagoon. I hope I'm not the only one who winced after hearing that statement. If you didn't, let me repeat that part. Quote, workers blasted large holes through the coral reef encircling Bikini Atoll, end quote. Can you imagine the wanton destruction of the environment? Right now, coral reefs around the planet are dying because of our actions, and if we do not do something, the coming generations will never see a coral reef. I hope that when that day comes, history will remember that some people bombed one of said coral reefs. I guess they did that for quote-unquote humanity too. The ships that were to be targeted included German and Japanese ships captured during World War II, and American ships too old or too damaged to be of further use. As launch day, which was to be July 1st, 1946 neared, plans shifted into high gear. The military began holding competitions and drills to see which B-29 crew would be selected to drop the first bomb, Able, on Bikini. After the drills and competitions were done, military officials selected Major Woodrow Swancutt to pilot the plane, known as Dave's Dream, for the mission. Major Harold Wood was to be his bombardier. The two of them had plenty of experience, having flown more than 70 bombing missions between them during World War II. On July 1, 1946, just after midnight, on Kawajalein Atoll, a crane hoisted Able into the bomb bay of Dave's Dream. At 3:20 a.m., Swancutt and his crew sat down for breakfast in the mess hall. At 5:42 a.m., Admiral Blundy gave the green light. Swancutt got into a jeep and drove onto the tarmac where the plane was. His crew joined him as he boarded it. At 5:53 a.m., Swancutt revved up the B-29's four engines. Two weapons specialists crouched inside the bay flipped the switch that prepared the bomb for detonation as the plane readied for takeoff. Politicians, international leaders, and journalists arrived to observe the test. To photograph the event, scientists and military officials set up hundreds of cameras. They placed the cameras almost everywhere, on unmanned drones, on land-based towers, on nearby observation ships, and on the target ships themselves. A fun fact before I continue. Nearly half the world's supply of film was used at Bikini. It was used to capture 50,000 photographs and 457 kilometers of movie film. Crazy, right? As Dave's Dream began to taxi down the runway at 6 a.m. local time, dozens of observer planes and unmanned drones were already in the air. The observer planes would cruise at a safe distance from the bomb to view the explosion and, of course, to film it. As for the unmanned drones, they would fly directly over the explosion to take close-up photos and measure radiation. At 8:30 a.m., Major Swancutt made a run over the Bikini Lagoon to spot his target. The target was the U.S. battleship Nevada. The Navy had painted it red, so it would be easier to spot from the air. A metronome on one of the target ships, the USS Pennsylvania, ticked out the countdown on global radio. As the seconds ticked away, Dave's Dream was flying at 28,000 feet. And as the countdown ended, the metronome fell silent. Wood, the bombardier, released Able just before 9 a.m. The bomb exploded 158 meters above the lagoon. A huge ball of fire shot high into the air and reached a temperature of 55,538 degrees Celsius, which is literally hotter than the surface of the sun. Swirling masses of flaming red, purple, and white clouds erupted from the lagoon. A mushroom-shaped cloud formed and rose as high as 12,192 meters into the sky. One of the reporters at Bikini Atoll would go on to say, quote, "When the flash came, it lighted up the sky and ocean with the light of many suns, a light not of the earth," end quote. Manned planes flew over the target array to check the ships for visible damage. Drone planes flew much closer to the explosion so they could obtain samples from the mushroom cloud. Remote-controlled drone boats measured the water in the lagoon for radioactivity. Due to the heat of the bomb, the radiation had been swept up into the atmosphere and dispersed over a massive area. The Navy would later claim that Ebol was a, quote, self-cleansing bomb. I don't need to tell you that this was actually untrue. Less than 6 hours after the explosion, Blandy gave the all clear. He was very happy with Ebol's performance. Quote, "The bomb was dropped with very good accuracy. I am very pleased with the performance of our task force in the operation. It could not have been better," end quote. On a much darker note, a month before the detonation, the US Navy had sent a ship, the USS Balson, to Bikini. The ship contained 146 pigs, 176 goats, 57 guinea pigs, and over 3,000 rodents. All those animals were part of the test, you know, so they could learn more about the effects of radiation on living creatures. At first, Admiral Blandy had insisted to the public that there weren't going to be animals in the testing. He later reversed course and said, quote, "A minimum number of animals will be used. We regret some of these animals may be sacrificed, but we are more concerned about the men and women of the next generation than we are about the animals of this one," end quote. Honestly, I have to ask, which men and women? Because it definitely wasn't Bikinian men and women of that generation, let alone those of the next. As expected, animal lovers around the world protested the use of animals, calling the plan cruel and barbarous. Dogs were originally part of the test group, but dog lovers protested so loudly that Admiral Blandy had no choice but to exclude them. 700 people went as far as to volunteer to serve as human test subjects instead of the animals, but the government declared the idea absurd. In preparation for launch day, sailors placed the animals on 22 of the target ships at duty stations that humans would typically occupy, such as decks and bridges. Some goats were shaved to mimic military buzz cuts to see if the explosion would affect military personnel with short hair. That doesn't even make sense. These people were just torturing those poor animals. Other animals were covered with sunblock to determine if sunblock protected against the flash and extreme heat of the explosion. Pigs, due to their skin having similar properties as human skin, were smeared with specialist lotions to see if it would protect them from harmful radiation. A few were even dressed in Navy uniforms to discover if fabric offered any protection against radiation. A quarter of the animals would die during the explosion. Over the next few months, most of the remaining animals would also die due to radiation damage. Unlike Ebol, which was detonated in the air, Baker would be detonated underwater. It would create a spectacle that few people would be able to forget. The first problem with Baker was that it was a very dangerous test. Experts had warned Admiral Blandy that such a test would contaminate the lagoon and the entire island because of its radiation. that radiation would remain in the water. Radioactive water could even drift thousands of kilometers and reach inhabited islands. As I said last time, hubris reigned supreme during these tests, and so, unsurprisingly, Admiral Blandy gave the order to proceed with the tests. The US Navy re-anchored the target ships that had survived Baker around a landing ship, mechanized, or LSM, that suspended the bomb 90 feet below the surface of the water in a casing made from the scrapped conning tower of a submarine. On launch day, Marshall Holloway waited in the control room aboard the USS Cumberland Sound, 24 kilometers from the target site. Holloway was a scientist. He had helped develop the world's first atomic bomb as part of the Manhattan Project. At precisely 8:35 a.m., he set the automatic bomb firing clock in motion. Finally, a radio signal triggered the detonation. Within a few millionths of a second, the explosion formed an underwater fireball bubble. It generated a shockwave that moved faster than the speed of sound. The shockwave dug a giant crater in the floor of the lagoon, about 60 meters below the surface of the water. Above the surface, a giant dome of water and superheated steam rose out of the water. 1 second after the explosion, the underwater fireball, which was now expanding, threw 2.2 million tons of water, sand, and pulverized coral into the air. The bubble then expanded to the point where it left the water in the form of a column of water. The center of the column of water was hollow and was filled with superheated steam. That column of water reached an astounding 1.6 kilometers into the air. The intense heat caused water in the humid air to condense, creating what is known as a Wilson condensation cloud. A Wilson condensation cloud occurs when explosives are used in very humid air. Not just atom bombs, even regular explosives, as long as they are hot enough. The cloud hit the water column for a few seconds before it collapsed into a donut shape and disappeared. The hollow column of water then came back into view. By then, it had climbed to an altitude of 3,048 meters. At that altitude, it lost momentum and became a mushroom or cauliflower-shaped cloud. I looked at the pictures but couldn't decide if it was a mushroom I was looking at or a cauliflower. The difference between the two is one belongs on pizza and the other one doesn't. 11 seconds after the explosion, lagoon water rushed into the empty space left by the water column, starting a series of atomic tidal waves. The first wave was 29 meters high. Luckily, it had leveled out by the time it reached the island, though some smaller waves would reach the island. Approximately 12 seconds after the blast, water from the column created a 274 meter base surge. A base surge looks similar to the dense mist that is created at the bottom of a huge waterfall. If you have ever seen pictures of Victoria Falls, then you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, ask Google. Most of the bomb's radiation fell or was captured by the base surge, thus contaminating the water. The huge tidal waves created by the water column, now highly radioactive, drifted 11 kilometers and rolled over all the surviving target vessels, thus contaminating them. Turns out the scientists' predictions had been accurate. You have got to listen to the scientists and follow the science. I don't think pride or patriotism are sufficient to protect from radioactive fallout, and that's why it's important to listen to the people who actually know what they are saying. After the contamination, the amount of radiation on the target ships immediately after the blast was 20 times greater than the lethal amount a person can absorb. 40 minutes after the explosion, patrol boats entered the lagoon to examine the damaged vessels. The US Navy would later claim that it had protected the servicemen from radiation. We know that isn't true because of a 1988 documentary by the name of Radio Bikini, which shows military servicemen wearing little to no protection as they inspect the target ships shortly after the explosion. Additionally, some observer ships and their crews were also exposed to radioactive fallout. 2 hours after the explosion, technicians briefly boarded the highly radioactive ships to retrieve test instruments. As one seaman stationed on the USS Sumner later recalled, quote, "We didn't know what was going on. No one told us anything about radiation. We were caught in what they called the downwind. A lot of debris fell on the Sumner. Mist, grit, sand, and pieces of rock. I picked up a little rock and put it in my pocket." End quote. By the time the sun set, an estimated 15,000 military officials, sailors, and scientists on close to 50 support ships entered the lagoon for post-detonation testing, or PDT. Most of those people boarded the ships carrying Geiger counters. According to eyewitness accounts, those people had regular shoes on with paper over them. While that was going on, a group of sailors were swimming in the water among dead fish. That same water would be pumped into the ship to make drinking water for the servicemen. And of course, the servicemen used the same water to wash their clothes with. As all that happened, no one even warned them about the water. For 2 months, sailors tried to decontaminate the target ships without any type of protection. They decontaminated the ships by scrubbing the decks with water, soap, and lye using mops and brushes. They used hoses to spray seawater over the decks in a bid to remove the radiation clinging to the vessels. The irony of it is, the seawater was even more radioactive than the ship. This meant that the use of soap, lye, water, brushes, and mops simply spread the radiation. Support ships moved in and out of the lagoon depending on the day's radiation readings. The radiation readings were made using Geiger counters, but unfortunately, in the humid, salty air, Geiger counters kept malfunctioning and those that didn't packed up. At the same time, scientists and the military were butting heads over the day-to-day operations on the island. Navy officials wanted the soldiers to continue trying to decontaminate the ships, while the scientists felt that the military was underestimating the dangers of radioactive contamination. The Navy, after some time, halted attempts to decontaminate the target vessels in the lagoon after they realized that it was a nearly impossible job. Of course, it was a nearly impossible job. You can't clean radiation using more radiation, unless they thought that the fighting fire with fire scenario also applied to radiation. After they gave up, some of the target ships were towed to Kwajalein and scuttled. Less contaminated vessels were towed back to the US, where they were decontaminated and decommissioned. Many were left at the bottom of the Bikini Lagoon. By the end of September 1946, all Operation Crossroads personnel had left Bikini. What had once been one of the most beautiful places on Earth and an important place for the people of the atoll was now a radioactive junkyard. The water was radioactive, the fish population decimated, the plant life irradiated, the beaches filthy, and the coral all but gone. All this had been done in the name of humanity, and yet it had also been done to humanity and to the planet at large. Thank you so much for listening. As promised, let me explain what happened last week. Since 2017, I've been part of the Windows Insider program. Long story short, on June 30th, I received a developer copy of Windows 11. It was a bit unstable but usable. I received a new build every Friday until the week before last. While using the dev builds of Windows 11, I ran everything from virtual machines to emulators. Well, last week, everything went wrong. While using my work PC on Tuesday, that's the PC that I also use for recording and editing. So Tuesday, I was using an emulator when I was suddenly hit with a critical error, green screen of death. The problem was, my PC couldn't even start up after it was forced to shut down by the unstable OS. After that, I knew what the problem was, and so I decided to fix it, like immediately, cause I couldn't post an episode. I flashed my UEFI with a new version and reinstalled Windows using a recovery drive. I then started up the new OS and started recovering my software and services and reinstalling over 200 drivers. By then, it was Saturday. After I did all that, on Monday, I noticed that my entire registry was corrupted, and so I had to reinstall the OS yet again and start everything over. Anyway, that was my crazy week. As usual, thank you so much for listening. Next week, I thought we'd change things up. So I'll not upload Bikini Part 3. Instead, I'll do a story on Stuxnet. Please remember to share this podcast with anyone you know. Until next time, goodbye.